Kid Hog, Penny Hog, at home with the hogs.
The state of our union is strong.
Yeah! Well, hello with the hogs.
And welcome. Thank you, Donald. And welcome home with the hogs. And very nice to have you with us. The heifer has popped out for a moment, but she'll be back in a second. You're listening to the radio magazine that is rooted in the one thing we all share. What is that? Well, we're all immigrants, aren't we? Haven't we all at some stage cut ties with the familiar to make a change, to start new lives? And isn't this a potentially bonding experience that we have in common here in the great expatria, the modern day Euro colony of English speakers that extends from Mallorca to Gibraltar, from exhilaration to exasperation, from partial understanding to blundering confusion, from an aha moment to lost in translation, from do I stay or do I go? We've all been there. We know these feelings. And at Home with the Hogs, we talk about them with you, don't we, my sweet?
We do. Good morning. I got diverted there.
You did. Yeah. Yeah. Well, nice to have you with us. Now, before we start telling you what we've got in the picnic box today, you won't realise this, but I'm wearing slippers.
Let me have a look. Hang on. I'm just going to have a look under here.
Yeah, have a look under the table.
Yes,
well, it's all about the mud from the flood, the chocolatey alluvial silt.
We like to spread the joy.
The river inundated us in back in October. And while it's no longer in the house, it does continue to surround us. Now, the shoes I wear are the shoes I wear normally. They're like boots, and they're called red backs, and they're bush boots made in Australia. They're this sort of elastic-sided ankle boots. Easy put on, easy take off. And they're named after an indigenous and deadly spider called the Redback, which was the subject of a hit record, actually, in 1969. And I'm going to sing a couple of lines.
How does it go, Kit?
You're going to join in with it.
No, I can't. I've never heard it before.
Okay, it goes like, there was a Redback on the toilet seat when I went there last night. I didn't see him when I sat down, but God, I got a fright. you get the idea. So while the rest of the Western world was listening to Hendrix and Jefferson Starship in 1969, the Australians were buying a record that went like that. So, and talking of Australia, actually, we present later in the second hour a radio play for your pleasure here at Home with Hog.
Get ready to snuggle up at home or stop the car, eh?
Yeah, it's called courtesy of our mercurial guest, Robbie Jeffries, and it's set on a cattle ranch near Alice Springs. So that's Robbie Jeffries recalling Australian days from about 12:20 on the show. Now, I don't know if Robbie is wearing red backs or wore them back then. We'll ask him. But Saturday before last, I wore mine into the studio here. Now, the thing about red backs is that their soles have deep, deep welts, which fill up with mud. They kind of grip really well, like sort of off-road tyres.
To help you walk in the mud.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, not that there's a great deal of mud in Australia, but they do have these
just in case
4x4 kind of treads, you know. And especially chocolatey alluvial silt, a substance people are unfamiliar with here in San Pedro and here at Talk Radio Europe in particular. And I was oblivious, actually, to, so I come into the studio wearing my red backs, having been at home, and I was unaware.
Just gently spreading them out at home, not noticing it, laying a top dressing, actually,
on the studio carpet, until producer Rob Humphreys took an unusually sharp intake of breath at the end of the show. So hands and knees, dustpans and brushes between us, we corralled the earth into litter bins, and all was spick and span, except apparently it wasn't. Because on Monday, more mud was discovered on the floor of the toilet, apparently. And I believe an internal investigation followed. The affair amplified into what Rob appropriately christened Mudgate.
Kit, the thing is, you are entirely guilty.
I am, and that's why I'm wearing Velcro Califor slippers in the studio
today. They
are today.
A treat to behold.
The redbacks are at the door. Now, in just a moment, we're going to welcome our first guest, aren't we, babes?
We are. He'll be here very shortly. His name's Stephen Rowell. He's been here and spoken to us before. And he helps domestic pets and animals to move on if they've been traumatised. So look forward to talking to him about energy, about animals, and if you have an animal that needs help, he may be the man to talk to. And perhaps, are we going to do a call-in as well?
We will. The lines will definitely be open.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that will be shortly after 1:30.
So that's from Computer. He's coming. Stephen Rowell, holistic behaviourist for dogs, from about 11:30 this morning. And we'll be opening the phone lines. And talking of opening the phone lines, we actually have someone on the line making quite a strange noise. Hello. Good morning. You're live at Penny the Hogs.
Good morning, Chet. Good morning, Penny. It's Gray. How are you? Good morning to you both.
Hello.
Nice to hear from you. What did you say your name was?
It's Ray. G-R-A-Y.
Oh, hi. Hello. Hello.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Good. Good. How are you, Gray?
I'm fine, thank you. I've got a pair of redbacks that have a relative brought back from Australia for me, 1981. They still wear them.
Yeah. Really, man. They're brilliant. Absolutely brilliant shoes, aren't they?
They're great shoes. You just slip them on and away you go. And like you, I've actually trod mud in various people's carpets. And
so I'm not the only one. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You just forget, don't you? Because like the tracks fill up so much.
Yeah, man.
They become part of the shoe and it just kind of falls out periodically. So
no, great. Yeah. That's all rubbish, I'm afraid. It's because you're a man and you can't see dirt.
Well, no, it is about... Of course you can't see dirt because they're on the bottom of your feet. How are you supposed to see the dirt?
You can't see dirt if you trail it around. You expect somebody else to clear it up after
you. Or
this is going to get nasty.
Well.
guilty is charged, Penny. I'm glad the clean-up operation at Casa Hogs in full flow, so...
Thank you.
That's cool, man. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
We're back.
Yeah. So, good. Well, keep on with the Redbacks. Did you say 1981?
1981, yeah.
Blimey.
That's how long I've had them. They're going a bit crispy now, though. A bit long. My arm's a bit crispy this morning from processionary caterpillars, but there you
really?
Go.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay, right,
that is another story. Once we get started on processionary caterpillars.
I went on a tree and I didn't realise how close to my arm they were.
Yeah. All right, Gray. Well, look, have a lovely weekend. Very
well,
nice.
Bless you, man.
Cheers, man.
Bye, Gray.
The Scourge of Auto Electrics is also on the programme today. The February Carnival season in España. It's not quite like Rio, is it? And Penn adopts an olive. Sit tight and enjoy the ride.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Well, a couple of little news items. First of all, yesterday, President Pedro Sanchez announced April the 28th as the date for Spain's third general election in 3 years. Home with the Hogs political correspondent Matthew Bennett from the Spain Report will be with us next week to review the excitement on offer this spring. And rugby. Well, if you're a fan, you'll know there is no Six Nations this weekend. But actually, there is. In the second tier of Six Nations European rugby, Spain play away to Georgia in Tbilisi. Last weekend, they beat Russia 16-14. You'll forgive me for mentioning this because there's nothing as odious as smug parents. But Mrs. Hogg and I are pretty au fait with Spanish rugby at the minute because...
Yeah, know every rule we do.
What's going on now? But no, the reason we are is because our boy Koibi is starting at number 8 against Georgia. That's 3 p.m. Spanish time tomorrow on Sunday. And you were going to try and find out how we could watch it, Poppet.
You could too. Yeah.
Well, that was one of the things you said you might do, actually.
That's one of the things you said that I could do. But yes, we will be watching it.
I think it's on TV, Television
really?
Deporte. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I actually don't have a clue. Yeah. Anyway, that's tomorrow.
Yeah, well, we hope Koibi will be with us next Saturday to talk about life in La Selección.
Yes, and also Georgia, how it is.
Yeah, really fascinating country, like way out there.
Do you know, I don't hardly even know where it is.
It's in the Caucasus.
Right, of course.
You know exactly where it is now, don't you?
Yeah, I'm picturing it now.
Now, babes, you're entreating us to adopt an olive.
Yeah, I read this only yesterday, and I think it's a brilliant idea. Adopt an olive tree or breathe new life into rural Spain. There's a lady called Sira Plana who proudly points to Olieti olives groves, which are now thriving thanks to an adoption scheme that has prevented this northeastern Spanish village from dying out. For an annual fee of €50, which is nothing, some 2,500 sponsors receive photos of their olive tree by mobile phone and every year get 2 litres of olive oil. I don't think they send the olive oil through the mobile phone. They must post it or something. But I think it's as well as the satisfaction of knowing their money will be ploughed back into the local economy and to help create jobs, sponsors also get to name their tree. She says, we tried to do it in a way that people would get emotionally involved in this project, she says, Plana, who's she's co-founder of Adopt an Olive Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that Spain is the world's largest producer of olive oil. And she said that when people explain why they decided to sponsor a tree, in the majority of cases, it's very, very emotional, and it's linked to a relative or a child, a grandfather. You know, you can obviously adopt an olive tree in the name of somebody you might have lost or loved.
Okay, so are these millennial olives, or centenarios?
Most of them are over 500 years old.
Right, yeah. Okay.
So basically what's happened is that the villages after the Civil War became depopulated, and there was nobody there. And still what isn't, to a large degree, there to care for the trees and to get the trees back into production. Because residents began moving away in sort of 1936 and to find better work in factories in the cities. And some parts of Spain were left with just 2 people per square kilometre, which is about the same population density as Siberia. So in this province of Teruel, where there's an enormous carnival happening this weekend, it's just got some 9 inhabitants per square kilometre. So it's massively dropped. But this project has started, it may not sound a lot, but 8 permanent jobs, including 6 agricultural workers. And that's also thanks to a new olive mill, which helps to keep families in the village. It helps sponsor a school, and it brings back life to deserted rural areas.
What a brilliant story. So it's not just about trees, it's about people and communities.
It's about people, communities and repopulation and moving out of cities. I mean, there's somebody here who's actually moved from Barcelona, where it was impossible to live because of high rents, etc., taken right deep into the campo, but with work at the other end. Now, if you want to get involved with this, I mean, there's other projects. I mean, more in the western region, you can, of Extremadura, you can adopt a cherry tree.
Never.
Yeah, you can. I'd love it.
I came through there the other day. The Gredos.
Yes.
All the cherries. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're interested in this, or you'd like to sponsor a tree for somebody or in somebody's name, it's the website is such Alpandrina, which means to adopt, alpandrinaunoliva.com.
Alpandrina unoliva.
Un olivo. If you put adopt an olive oil, get in touch with us. I can pass it on. It's government are getting involved, but also there are NGOs who are also involved in these projects to get people back into the campo.
Last time on this programme, we wallowed in the frustration of trying to open the electric windows on Patrice.
Still haven't, but
which
yeah.
is Penn's new car. They do actually open, don't they? And of
they
course,
do.
Inadvertently, without thinking, especially at an autopista toll, one depresses the button and the glass dutifully disappears into the door. But does it come up again? No, it doesn't. We do. We can get it up with a strange sort of. We have to stop the car, open the door. One of us is pressing the button or lifting the button up, and the other grabs the glass between the clasped hands with great force and tries to ease it up.
We'll
and
it never get it
I mean,
right.
It doesn't.
New posh car, does it work? Nah.
Oh, it's just about electrics, isn't it? I mean, they're a nightmare. The window still malfunction has as much to do with the eye-watering 570 euros we've been quoted for a new electric motor. Bring back the window winder. We're starting a campaign at Home with the Hog School. Bring back the window winder. I mean, electrics on cars are so out of order. Hand in hand with the safety hysteria, they become a supreme irritant, as well as all the reversing sirens, parking hooters, seatbelt chimes. My car, new car, of its own volition, yesterday activated a delinquent bonging noise when I opened the door.
Was that only yesterday?
Yeah, yes. And I'm not when I'm driving or anything. When I'm parked, driving.
Can you
expand? I open the door, and I know I've got the door open. Why is it bonging?
Can you describe bonging?
Well, if I was high tech enough, I was thinking of recording the bonging noise so I could play it to you.
Bong. That's quite nice.
It's not monastic. It's not meditative. It's just annoying. So I open the door to get out, and the bonging noise serenades me as I alight the vehicle. And as soon as I shut the door, it stops. And I know it's stopped because I've actually pressed my ear to the door to listen. So then you get the manual, and you try looking up El bon que me molesta in the manual, and I can assure you it's not there. Right, cracking on, babes. Carnival in Spain. Just how much of a damp squid is carnival in Spain?
Well, it's only a damp squid if you don't get into the party spirit, really. But
raining and there's only about three people a float, as there was in the Gulf scene. Carnival, I remember the last one I went to.
Carnival?
Was in 2003.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it's probably best if you stay
indoors. Why do they have it in February?
If you just wait one moment, I will tell you. Now, the Roman Catholic calendar between the days of Epiphany and Lent is the reason you have carnival. Because carnival means to put away the meat, because Catholics are not meant to eat meat during Lent.
Oh, really? From carne.
Yes.
How interesting.
Isn't it?
You're a wealth of information.
I am, Tony. Well, so is SpanishFiestas.com, funnily enough. I didn't remember.
Is that your secret?
It's funny enough, it is, yes. Actually, till the 17th, I'm not quite sure what the date is today, but this is the last weekend of Las Bodas de Isabel de Segura, where you can go and have a medieval wedding or dress up in medieval dress to reenact a medieval wedding. And that is in Teruel, which we were talking about just now, where they have the Adopt an Olive. It's all going on up there.
Teruel, yeah.
Teruel.
That's a great town.
Which is to imitate a story of two young lovers where there was a family where the father said, well, you can come back and marry my daughter when you have made enough money to look after her. So the lover disappears and he comes back 5 years later, but a day too late because she has already married the day before.
I can know the story, yes.
You know the story. And so he creeps into her marital bedroom that first night and goes to kiss her, and she refuses, and she dies on the spot. And it is funeral a few days later, she dresses up in her bridal gown and dies on the spot. So anyway, that's the story.
It's
all very jolly. Yeah.
Yes.
Or you could go to the festival.
Carnival is more fun than that, isn't it? Supposedly.
You could go. Yeah. Well, you could. It's all sort of, you know, tragedy and flamenco and what have you. Or you could go to the flamenco festival of Jerez, which goes on to March the 3rd, which starts on the 22nd. And there's a massive carnival in Tenerife from, again, till the 27th, which is actually twinned with Santa Cruz in Brazil.
Right. I can imagine, yes, that's a bit closer to South America, Tenerife, and also the weather's better. I can imagine that's more fun, more of a carnival.
Yeah, I think, as I said, it's best if you stay home and watch the rugby. Or in Sitges, there's the biggest gay carnival in the world from the 26th of February to March the 10th. Or in Cadiz, you can go to a carnival this weekend and take part in a marathon. So there's lots going on, and now's the time to do it.
Carnival weekend, if you fancy it. We're going to take a break now, and then we're back with a story of Spain.
This is Talk Radio Europe. At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
So, shout out to Ella Chi Wolfman and Paul Jewson, both of whom are listening. Lovely to have your company. You may not have noticed, but we weren't with you last week. We went to Madrid instead. Small matter of...
I thought you were
going to
ask me, where were we?
Where were... Sorry, let me bring you up.
Remember.
Yeah, no, I know, we went to Madrid, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, do you remember that?
Yeah, vaguely,
wasn't
yeah.
So long ago. It was a small matter of how to get there. I'm going to take this call just because I wonder who it is. Hello, you're live at Home with the Hogs.
Oh, good morning. I thought I was still on the commercial break. My name is Claudia.
Hi, Claudia.
I'm quite sure about the Apadrina un Olivo. I think it should end with an O because un Oliva doesn't really exist.
No, that's right, because it's an aceituna, isn't it?
I'm so sorry.
That's what I said, babe.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Claudia.
Okay, and about the banging noise on your vehicle, just find the fuse.
Bonging noise.
Yes.
Oh, no. You know what? If you try... that is a Pandora's box, you know, once you open that up and start pulling fuses
that's
out.
That's not good advice to Kit to take out a fuse. Oh, no.
I'll just put up with the bonging noise.
Yeah.
Thanks, Claudia.
Okay.
Bye
you're
now.
Welcome.
Yeah, we were talking about getting to Madrid. So how do you get there? Do you drive in a car whose windows won't open or stop... one that bongs incessantly. Anyway, the heifer gets fidgety on long car journeys, don't you, babes?
And, yeah, they go and on
then,
far too long.
And then where do you park when you get there? Cars, even though you can pack expansively, like taking jackets, jumpers, and more than one pair of shoes, can be an expensive encumbrance in a city. Or do you fly? Oddly, probably the cheapest option, but certainly, to my mind, the least pleasurable. So we caught a train, the AVE, no less, from Malaga to Madrid. Travel time, 2 hours, 44 minutes. Price, €87, 59 centimos, one way.
Now, I think you've got the price a bit wrong there, actually.
Oh, did I?
Yeah,
I thought I read it off the ticket.
Did you?
That's one way.
Okay. Well, of course, you have to get there.
You have to get where?
You have to get actually to the train station. I know that sounds obvious, but having got there, you have to be... I found it quite exciting knowing that you don't have to go through all the... You don't have to go through the checks and the security. There is some, but it's not nearly as intrusive. You don't have to strip right down to your underwear. So that's good. And you feel it's a lot less crowded and you know you've got your seat. I mean, like on a British train... You get on it. You're not guaranteed and you're not buying a seat. I think that makes a huge difference to travelling. Anyway, AVE stands for Alta Velocidad Española. So that figures. And it also means bird, which also infers flight and speed. Now, the first line was opened in 1992 and the vehicle travels at, guess how much, how many kilometres an hour? The train, sorry.
Well, I clocked it at 300 kilometres an hour.
Yeah, 310 kilometres an hour. That's pretty fast.
Yeah, that's rocking.
Yeah, that's Spanish high speed, but they're also high speed. And it's actually the longest high-speed railway network in Europe with 3,240 kilometres and the second longest in the world after China's.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, good old Spain. That's
good
fantastic.
Absolutely.
China, of course, is a much bigger country.
That's right. Yes. Well, I think they are building more, or constructing more railway lines. And I think to get one down here as far as Algeciras would be very nice and jolly handy. In fact, if they open the Algeciras line at all, that also would be very handy for people who are stuck without any kind of transport.
Scandalous.
There were a couple of railway buffs sitting next to us. Did you notice taking thrilling video footage of leaving the station, which was basically a concrete wall?
And the flat plains of Castilla-La Mancha.
Yeah,
they were thoroughly engaged.
Thoroughly engaged home videos. But unlike the rest of the Iberian broad gauge network, the AVE uses standard gauge. So what does that mean? It means that you can just like click into the French system if necessary. Well, if necessary, if you want to go on into France.
Okay. You can carry on.
Yes, because Spain uses a different gauge to the rest of the, which was to prevent invasion, of course. But one little thing you asked me to find out, because I would like to go and say hello to Stephen now, is that Maria Zambrano, we were asking about the train station in Malaga, is called Maria Zambrano, and she was an essayist who was born in 1904 and a philosopher. Station is named after her.
And she's an essayist?
Essayist, as in writing essays.
Oh, right, right.
Best essay, which was El Hombre y Lo Divino.
El Hombre y Lo Divino. See? Okay, yes. Okay, that's great.
Woman after my own heart.
Well, before you run off, babes, we got Kenny on the line from
Kenny, good morning, hi.
Good morning, Kit.
Good morning, mate.
Just what you were talking about there, about the different gauges. We watched the series with Chris Tarrant, Extreme Railway Journeys.
Yeah.
And he went to some of the stations and the rail network within Spain. And where the border is, where the trains come through from France, the train actually goes through something, it looks like a workshop-type tunnel.
We've done that, yes.
And the train is lifted. The passengers don't even know it's happening because it's going up just a crawl. The train is actually lifted and the wheels are designed. They don't have axles on the AVE. They only have bearings either side, so it lightens the train anyway. So what it does, the gauge is changed automatically by hydraulics, and it changes to the, if it's coming from France, it changes to the Spanish gauge, and if it's going the other way, it changes to the French gauge, and it's lowered again onto the tracks, continues its journey, and the passengers don't even know it's happening.
Well, you do know it's happening because you kind of stopped, and there's this sort of clunking noise going on.
But is that for the AVE train?
Yes, it does that as well.
Right.
It goes through because when they bring goods through from France, it used to take hours and hours to transfer things or change over. So what they did, it was invented, I think it was a Spanish invention, probably in combination with the French, but what they do is this hydraulic system lifts the train and the gauge is changed also at the same time. It's in the air. It's only centimetres off the rail tracks, but it's actually, the gauge is changed automatically and it drops down on the other side and continues.
Kenny, do you like rail travel? Do you use the train?
No, actually, we're ashamed to say, well, we've used the train once here, and that was from when we holidayed, and that was from Algeciras to Ronda.
Okay.
On that wonderful old line.
The line that is actually that is actually closed now.
Which is
scandalous. It will open again, but in the meantime, to the detriment of all the communities that live along and depend on that line. Kenny, we're going to have to leave you now because we're going to be welcoming our guest Stephen Rowell. Bye bye, mate. Have a happy weekend. Holistic behaviour in dogs. After this break.
With the Hogs. With the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
And welcome back. It's our great pleasure to welcome Stephen Rowell, helping domestic pets and traumatised animals to move on with their lives. Stephen, hi, good morning to you.
Great to be here. Back on At Home with the Hogs.
It's great. It's a lovely sunny day.
Yes.
It's a bit chilly out there. It's positive.
Chilly and grey, yes.
Yeah. It is. Nice and cosy in here. So, Stephen, your slogan for this year is change the energy and change the life.
That's right, yeah.
So if I was to ask you, energy is all around us in many forms.
Yeah.
What would that mean?
Right, well, there's numerous different types of energy, okay? And you've got thermal energy, which is from is heat. You've got light energy, like from the sun. You've got mechanical energy, say, car or machinery. You've got gravitational energy, which is the Earth itself, and we're stuck on it because of the gravitational pull. Energy, sound is an energy. You've got nuclear energy. We can go on. But what we're looking at is chemical energy. That's what we produce energy from, a chemical reaction, and so do animals.
Okay? Our own chemicals within our bodies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, where does it come from? Okay, so it comes from within the heart, and within the heart there is a mini pacemaker, and it is called the sinoatrial node, which contains electrolytes, and they mix together and they create the charge, which dissipates, and then that flows all around the body. And that's the same in any animal.
Okay, can you see this node? Is it
Well, it's within one of the ventricles of the heart.
Okay.
So you can't see
Can't actually see it. Okay.
No.
Yeah, I know I can't see it now, but yeah. I'd like to be pragmatic on these things. Yeah, show me your node. Yeah. Okay, so it's, it emanates from the heart.
Okay, so what do we need it for? What do we need this electricity flowing everywhere for? Well, it's for information. It passes signals around the body to various organs in the body. And that's what it's for, and it's an information network.
Okay.
Okay.
Like the hub.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the science of it, the concept of animal energy or the energy field in medicine goes back 200 years at least. And you had what they called nature therapists or natural therapists that talked about the vital force that surrounded you back
there. like the chi,
that sort of thing.
Okay.
That's what it is. And they would talk about then about it, that it's diminished or disturbed before a physical disease takes place. So there's, in that field around you, or around your dog, or around any animal, there is already information in that field before anything occurs. Now, the word information is really vital, because that's what I get onto towards the end.
Okay.
Now, the science of it is...
So this information, how is that perceived? Is that as it were, a different vibration?
Yes. Now, let me get into the science of it.
Okay.
And then I'll explain to you. Right. Now, the first scientist to do any real serious work was a man called Harold Burr. He was an American scientist. And he did tests on... he'd done numerous experiments, but he did significant tests on 102 women at New York Bellevue State Hospital. And 96 of those women tested, their fields were tested... and they had pelvic issues. The field showed a decline. And when they had a biopsy done, there were malignant changes in the cells.
So he was able to measure the field?
Yes.
Okay.
So
I won't ask you how.
Well, he designed the electrodes. It's like when you have an ECG or something like that,
okay.
But they don't actually have to touch the skin.
You can pick it up.
Yeah, you can pick it up on the outside.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was a scientific experiment that proved that you can read this field, and it does show things about your health before before it occurs within the body. It's already showing there's something wrong. Okay. So, on from that, they actually developed a device to test your field. But the medical fraternity wouldn't take it up.
So Harold Burr invented a machine that he could test the fields with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, some years later.
Which is like a precursor, a warning to potential illness.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But again, it's about that there is information within that field. Okay. So now, with making the connection, and how does it affect animals or your dogs or your horses... when I've always said, when you go into a room, and there's someone that you find that you maybe like or don't like, and you never met them before in your life.
The vibe.
Yeah, it's yeah. Fine. Well, that's the energy, and you're picking up on that energy.
Okay.
Okay. So that's how that works.
Yeah, but how subjective is that? How much of a clear reading do you get in actual fact? Surely the vibe you pick up from someone is in some way dependent on the vibe that you bring into the room.
Well, you're bringing your own energy into the
room. You are.
So your energy picks up on theirs.
Yes, absolutely.
It's what we've determined is that the energy, although it's not as researched as much as it should be, is actually an organ of the body. It's just as important. Because if the energy is not flowing properly, or something within you is not physically, like an organ's not working properly, then neither will your energy.
Sure, so. Sure.
Okay.
It all be, but it's also a fairly nebulous concept, isn't it? This.
Well, I think maybe, Stephen, are you trying to say that it's actually reasonably concrete that it can be tested?
Yeah, it is.
I think that's what you're saying scientifically.
Okay.
Let's go on with that.
Yeah. We're talking about a way of empirically testing energy.
Yeah. Well, more experiments have been done by that. There was a doctor called Sheldrake in the UK, and he did a lot of experiments. And one of them was he performed experiments on cells. And he infected cells in one petri dish. And the cells from that same body, there was another set of cells in another petri dish. And the cells that were infected... they eventually died, but the ones that weren't infected became sick as well. So it's
transmitting. So they caught, yeah.
And it wasn't a case of cross-contamination because it happened in, they could put it in another room and it did the same. So you're getting a transfer of information from one cell to another. Well, that's through energy. There was no other source. So
Okay. Get it. So, and that was Sheldrake.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So this is all based in fact. This is when you talk about energy, it's not, you know, airy fairy or anything like that. It's real stuff.
Okay. So, yeah, I get it absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah,
we've
so
got quite a few questions here, but yeah.
Okay, go on then.
Well, I was going to ask. So, for example, if you're in hospital, I'm talking humans, or say, a veterinary hospital, because we're talking animals here.
Yeah.
Can you get, if you've got a sick animal, can the animal in the next door cage, as it were, pick up on that sickness?
Yes, you could pick up on the vibe, but he's not actually got the sickness.
Right.
He won't get that itself.
Okay.
That's a physical thing, unless it's a contagious disease, of course.
Right,
but
right.
No, it won't. That won't be transferred
okay.
that way.
Okay.
It's just purely information, that's all.
Right.
So,
okay.
But it's a bit like being in the room with a depressed person. It won't be long.
Won't be before you are too, unless you have some kind of barrier
exactly.
or some way to protect yourself.
Exactly.
Okay.
So a dog could be in a hospital and it's with a lot of other down, depressed dogs, and it'll pick up on their energy and they'll all be in the same.
Okay, yeah, I understand that. So how do you work with animals using this energy?
Well, it's not the tool, it's just one. I work with it in a Reiki sense.
Reiki, what's Reiki?
Reiki healing, and that Reiki healing is based on a universal unseen energy. Now, as I've said, there's so much energy all around. Who's to say which one we're picking up on? But it's based on the universal source of unseen energy, and you transfer that through you to the patient.
Okay. So for people listening, then, if they're interested in Reiki, that's R-E-I-K-I. Okay. Reiki healing.
Yeah.
And there's different sort of levels of it. Would that be right?
When you're studying it, there's level 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
And mastership level, that's the third one. So.
Right. Okay.
But Stephen, your work is with animals largely, or do you work with people as well?
No, that's my wife deals with the people and I deal with the...
using Reiki.
Yes, if I think it's necessary. As I say, it's one of the tools. It's not the only tool.
So. All right. Can you give us an example, a case study of the way that you've helped an animal using Reiki?
Yes, I've... trying to think, there's numerous. One of the standout cases was a dog that was seeming to attack itself, attack its rear end. It was going around in circles, and again, a terrible state, and all the other dogs that live with it, they were doing the same.
They were sort of catching the vibe.
This had happened.
Was it an English Bull Terrier?
No.
Okay.
No, it was a Bedenko cross.
Right.
And it was sort of like chasing its tail, but it got a lot more aggressive than that. And it would happen in the night, it could happen randomly in the day, you could give it a bone, something like that, it would start it then.
We're talking about a kind of self-harming here.
Yes, that's what it looked like. It actually turned out to be a psychological problem. But I worked with this dog on a Reiki basis because its energy was scattered. It was all over. It just wasn't good. It was very weak. So we had to rebuild his energy and create a calm environment for this dog.
Okay, so just take us into the room. I'm trying to imagine the session. There's you and the dog, and what happens?
Okay, well, the dog goes on a table in front of me, and then he will go through at least half an hour of me placing my hands on him and until he is calm and until I think I've dealt with it enough for this dog to end the session.
When you put him on the table, is he already in an aggravated state?
No.
He's not. He's reasonably relaxed.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's just you and the dog.
You see, I have a calm energy again. I have a calm energy. And when dogs come into a presence with me, they are calm. And a lot of dogs, if you put them on the table, they'll get into a panic. But when I do it, They don't, because we've created calm. I'm calm. There's nothing to be worried about. We go on the table and relax.
Okay, so they've sensed your energy as a precursor to the treatment.
Yeah.
And the Reiki itself is a laying on of hands?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And what are you feeling with your hands?
Well, you learn to attune yourself. It's like reading the energy and where...
Sort of a warmth.
Yeah.
Literally a temperature.
It can be, yeah.
Fizzing, feeling.
If there's a problem within the body, I can feel heat.
Yeah.
And I can pick it up that way.
Do you think that animals themselves have a healing sensibility?
A healing sensibility in what?
Well, they're using dogs these days to... literally sniff out or smell, I don't know what the terminology is, people with cancer or cancer spots.
Yeah.
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 So is that a healing?
Well, it's picking up.
Picking up on the energy,
on
this field.
Information that's within,
right.
within that person.
Okay.
Because a lot of these dogs that have picked up on things like that have done it way before it's a problem.
Okay, so, but you just can't necessarily read the... You can't speak to them, so say this is a...
No.
Yeah, yeah. Because my mother used to suffer from petit mals, and my sister, she had a sheepdog.
What are petit mals?
It's a very sort of mild form of epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
When you sort of go into some kind of coma type thing, it's just like a mild fit.
Yeah.
And, but my sister's dog... would, just before this happened to my mum, would go and sit next to her.
Yeah, because there's change in the energy.
Yeah, the change in this kind of some electrical field. And we said, Tubby's gone and sat next to mum. Something's about to occur. And indeed, it's like, of course, my poor mum, like, oh, no, I know what's going to happen now. But it was actually strangely comforting. And the dog just would stay with her until it was over. Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah, dogs... do suss it, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
They say they're very, very strong receptors of energy. I mean, if I'm agitated around my dogs, they know it immediately.
Yeah, yeah. This is what, an example I say. You can't, when you're around a dog, you can't fake confidence. And you could have the best poker face in the world.
Yes.
But it won't make any difference because if you're not exuding that confidence.
Yes, very interesting. I was at I was doing an estimate the other day for a client who had a ridgeback, really large ridgeback. And this guy was kind of on the edge. He was kind of boisterous. And I reckon to be quite good with dogs. We've got dogs and I've got a big dog. But I was watching my reaction to this ridgeback and he was bouncy and not entirely stable. And I didn't trust him. Yeah. And then I was wondering how that lack of trust was manifesting in my behavior and how much of that he was picking up. Oh my God, he's going to attack me.
They will pick that up. But it's not just, as I say, energy is something you have to take into account. It's not just about that. I mean, when you're in a physical presence with a dog, it's how you physically act as well. It's not just the energy. You can't just stand there and, I'll just stand there and he'll read my energy and that's fine.
Cause yes. So there are poses that you can take. For example, forgive me for mentioning Caesar Milan, but if he goes into a bad dog's den, he'll make sure, for example, that he doesn't give it eye contact.
Yeah. But if you go into another dog's territory, we don't, as people, we don't do this. We go to friends' houses, we don't think about it. But if you do, you really should go sideways, not frontways.
Uh-huh.
Because frontways is full on.
Into a dog's territory, you're talking about. I thought you meant somebody's house. No.
Well
yeah, either way. I'll come in sideways,
Very old person.
No, well, we won't
come in sideways.
You should edge on sideways because coming full front on is
that.
Aggressive.
No, I get that. And you don't want to reverse in either because you can't see what's going on. You might trip over him. That would be really
domestic
bad.
Dogs tend to get desensitized to all of that sort of thing, but that, you know, some don't.
Okay. So, okay. Interesting. Yeah. So that's so in your work then do dogs...
can we take this call?
Of course.
It's Carol and hi Carol.
Hi my dear.
And do you want to ask something?
You
want to ask Stephen something?
I have three little Westies, and the oldest of the Westies is going on 17 years. And she is, what's happening, I've taken her to the vet. The vet said, it looks like dementia. She stands in the middle of the room. She doesn't know in what direction she's going in. She follows me, even to the when I'm cooking or anything. She's standing at the back of my leg. So I've got to be very careful because I could fall over her.
So it sounds like your sister's dog. Carol, I'm gonna have to stop you there and get Stephen to answer your question very quickly because, well, what is the question?
Okay, my darling. The question is there anything I could do to help her? Because the other dogs go to her and lick her and make her angry. They actually make her angry so that she's moving. Is there anything I could actually do?
45 seconds.
Yeah, hi, Carol. Yeah, I've come across a few of these cases lately with dementia, and unfortunately it's mental, so it's not a lot of logical things. So you're going to get a lot of illogical things happen. And your other dogs, talking about energy again, they're going to pick up on this, and they may pick on her. It's weak. It's a weakness. So they're going to act like dogs towards her. The only thing you can is find somebody like me who does Reiki, and that will balance her out. It will calm her down. It won't stop the dementia, but it will calm things down.
And Stephen, how can we find you?
You can contact me by phone on 665-235-689.
Let's get that number again. 665-235-689.
Or you can email me on stephenrowell@outlook.com.
Stephen, it's been illuminating. Thank you very, very much for coming in.
That's okay.
Until the next time. Coming your way in the next hour, we meet Robbie Jeffries, who takes us flying in a terrifying small plane over Alice Springs. Well, buenas tardes. Before we get too wordy with our guest, Robbie Jeffries, let's enjoy this classic together.
Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Broadcasting to 500,000 listeners across Spain and over 120 countries worldwide, this is Talk Radio Europe's Saturday magazine, At Home with the Hogs. Penn and Kit here, delighted to have you along for the second hour of the show. Now, we can't keep him waiting any longer. He's been working up such a head of steam next door. The windows have been misting up. A very special guest, traveller, philanthropist, raconteur, and a recently arrived resident of Hispania. It's our great pleasure to welcome Robbie Jeffries, Home with the Hogs.
Oh, Mr. Hogg, you make me feel so at home. Thank you very much.
And the sun's come out just as you started speaming. Can you see that? Look at the beams
that's
coming through the window.
It's coming at us now, isn't it? It's coming at us.
That's uncanny. Robbie, to get a sense of your extraordinary life, I want to dip into your story during a period of relative calm, 9-to-5 normality, while you worked in London for something called the Learning Skills Council.
That's right. It was a Tony Blairite organisation. It was specific, and I won't bore people. It was
so we're going back, 10 years?
Yeah. Okay. It was funding post-16 education. And I looked after, wait for it, the European Social Fund, for one of my jobs, and I looked after something called a Pan London 2 programme, which did exactly that. Yeah, I know. I used to go to
conferences. Over.
Well, I mean, all I heard at conferences every show.
Yes.
Exciting
so,
stuff.
Anyway, moving on. You took redundancy in 2011.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Since then, you've had cancer. Mm-hmm. You've been in 4 coups. Mm-hmm. You've been shot at twice. Mm-hmm. You've been held hostage on one occasion.
Oh, but they were very pretty people that held me hostage, Mr. Hogg. So, you know, it had certain benefits. Bless them.
Okay, that sort of hostage. Right. And you visited in your life, you've been, and largely since then, 48 separate countries. So what actually happened? Was this was there a road to Damascus moment?
Do you know what I think it was? And I think anybody who's lived and been affected by a serious illness has a road to Damascus
going back to the cancer. Yeah.
That they sort of think, well, hang on a minute, that you hear the clock ticking. And I think if you do hear the clock ticking, you think, well, I can do that. I'll have a go at that.
And what's not to lose?
What's not to lose? Yeah, you know, what's not to lose? I was fortunate. I had melanomas from my days in Australia, which we'll come to later. But it was a great cathartic moment, a release. It was just getting rid of all the trappings. Suddenly, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to have a go at this. And that's really what happened.
A major energy change.
Yeah, huge.
As Stephen would have pointed out.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, these are extraordinary adventures, but let's set the context. You were working in Africa, yes, having left London. You worked in Africa for an outfit called Solar Links. What was that about?
I was a volunteer. Without going into too much story, always happens when you least expect it. I met this incredible lady called Phyllida Purvis, who is the operator and founder of Solar Links. And I met her, of all such places, at the Henley Royal Regatta. And I said to her, and I quote, "I'm bored." Well, she's a bit, well, why do people like you get bored? And I said, "I don't know, but I'm bored." "Well, I've got a thing for you," she said. "I've got a very good thing for you. You can come and help me in Africa." and she really was. She's wonderful lady. She had pleated skirts and a lovely clip, you know, just on the side. Yeah. And she was.
Yeah.
She was a lovely, like, Margaret Rutherford type character.
So Barbara Woodhouse, the dog trainer.
Gracious
lady,
me, yes. She was just absolutely wondrous and a huge heart and very getting. And she said, "Well, you'll come out, can't you? You'll come out to me in sub-Saharan Africa."
And so what was she doing in Africa?
Well, she'd set up Solar Links. And
Solar Links?
It's S-O-L-A-R, new word, Links.
And Solar Links is what?
Is a charity specifically for funding small solar panels on the side of rural homes.
Mud huts.
We put solar panels on mud huts.
Yeah.
And what it's there to do, it generates power for lighting and to charge mobile phones. Now, you might think, why does the African need a mobile phone? Well, to be honest with you, it's the cheapest form of communication that's in sub-Saharan Africa, the mobile phone network.
Well, there ain't
really?
No landlines.
Really?
There ain't
really?
No landlines. Yeah. Well, the landlines, they're there. But in Africa, especially in Uganda, they seem quite expensive. Well, you see, mobile phone technology is what it is.
Yeah.
So these were like little micro businesses as well. So they'd have this pack put in their house with two lights, a solar panel, a battery, if you like, a consumer unit, plus they could plug mobile phones in.
Yeah.
So they could actually sell their power that they generate from the sun to plug other people's mobile phones in.
To people who didn't have their own
solar panel. That's the way. And also what we were doing is trying to say to these people, don't use kerosene. Kerosene blows things up and burns things down.
They're using kerosene.
Only form of light. So these little, okay. They'd have these little, like this glass here, they have a little kerosene and a little wick
in their homes
that would flood out smoke and fumes.
Yeah.
And also huge fire risk and wouldn't give much light.
Yeah.
So there were a high degree of people having snake bites in their homes because they couldn't see the snakes.
Ooh.
But children couldn't do their homework at night because they couldn't see anything by it. So we would try and sew links to give these rural communities, especially in northern Uganda, we'd probably specialise in Law's Republican Army area, right at the top of northern Uganda, to give people a start again, to get them light. And with this, a lot of other charities followed our way with water. Well, water came first, light. And also with our organization, it gave people micro businesses so they can learn how to, if you like, generate some money for themselves. And they also stopped using kerosene and put whatever they could contribute from their kerosene into a pot to repair the light themselves, because it will go wrong eventually.
The solar.
Okay.
But they would also form large cooperatives, so there would be 400 or 500 of these people in a large cooperative, and they'd have money left over at the end of the year.
Really?
And they could buy cattle. They could buy chickens. They could buy some land.
And is it still happening now?
It's still happening now. I mean, yeah, look, we've had great successes. We've had not failures, difficulties. I mean, we were in South Sudan, and obviously everybody knows what's happened in South Sudan. That in itself was difficult. But we've had communities that have taken ownership of themselves, if you like, empowered themselves to move on and to... You know, light their own schools, for instance. They pay for lighting their own schools.
Going back to this original conversation you had with Miss Purvis, it's quite an interesting conjecture to admit to someone, I'm bored.
Oh, yes, I did.
Because really you're saying, entertain me.
Yeah, entertain me. Yeah.
And ignite my life.
Yes, please.
And has Solar Links done that?
Yes. I mean, I don't do so much of it now.
You're not so bored anymore.
No, I don't do so much of it now because I obviously live in Spain. But the plan will be to start again when I, you know, fully moved over here permanently. Absolutely. Because it's a real passion of mine to see these communities move the next step. It's phenomenal.
And when we were talking earlier, what I like about the sound of this work is that the money goes directly to... Yeah.
Absolutely. When I do one of my trips, Solar Links isn't paying for me. So if someone gives Solar Links, let's say, a tenner, a tenner gets to the end user.
Yeah.
There's no middlemen. There's nobody. We don't employ anybody. It's really done.
It's not on all admin and all that stuff.
It's philanthropic.
Exactly.
So it's that type of
people who can afford to do it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Got it.
So, Robbie, let's go back to these anecdotes that I referred to earlier. You've been held hostage once. Alluded to the fact that wasn't altogether.
Well, it was. It was unfortunate. Unfortunate. Again. You get yourself caught up in a situation where another person or organisation or group of people think you may have some money.
Right.
Why? Because you've got a pair of jeans on and you've got a watch that works.
And then you're European.
And you're European. Mm-hmm.
So this was in Africa?
Well, no, this particular hostage taking was in northern Thailand after a coup.
Oh,
so
right.
I'd gone on a holiday. So it was all very interesting, really. And it was in a place... on the Burmese, this is where you don't drink and hike. You get confused where you are, Penny.
You stepped over the border into Burma.
Burma.
I've done that.
Have you?
And I got caught up in a gun battle.
Ah, yeah, probably
that is a conflagration.
People.
Yeah, that area. The Shan area.
Yes. And there's a huge disputed area, and I forget what it's called, but after the end of the Second World War, it was all sort of supposedly going to be a separate part of Burma, independent state, all the rest of it. Never quite happened. So those individuals that are there are a little bit annoyed. and so I was held for a period of, I would say, about three very pleasant days. They fed us extraordinarily well. I realised I was held hostage 12 hours after it happened, so because I couldn't get to the loo without someone being there. I thought, well, it was quite fun to begin with, but really that's enough now, you know. And then this very nice man came out of nowhere and said, well, we're holding you hostage. He spoke like that, terribly clipped. Unbelievable. And we were actually held in a mud hut until they thought they could rattle someone for some money. Well, I've never had money. Well, it came my way and it went different ways. But I never had a lot of money. And he was hoping that someone would come out of the ether with a bag of cash and say, there you are, lovely man. There's your cash. Can we have that puff back, please?
Right.
Didn't happen.
Right.
Very upsetting for me.
Robbie, Southeast Asia, I want to talk to you about on another occasion.
Yeah.
Because I know you've had extraordinary adventures in Southeast Asia. We've alluded to Pol Pot.
I will do your story around
enough.
Pol Pot.
We're just going to drop that out
there.
That's
episode 2.
That's episode 2.
Absolutely. Let's go back to Africa.
Yeah.
Now, you were working in southern Sudan and northern Uganda.
Yes.
And how optimistic are you for the place from the intensity of your experiences there? How optimistic are you for Africa?
I am very optimistic, so especially for sub-Saharan Africa, where we're talking about. If you want an example of, if you like, a country that is really pulling out of this, where it was top of our list of agendas 10 years ago, Rwanda. Rwanda is a wonderful country to visit now. It's calm. It's got a democratic elected government. It really is pushing forward.
Because in the 90s...
You heard about the Tutsis and the Hutsis.
It was just hell on earth.
It was hell.
Yeah.
What I think I'm very optimistic about, and what I always go... And this is a personal opinion, and everybody's different. It took the United Kingdom and Spain and any other democratic country quite a length of time to have some sort of democracy going on. Now, we can't expect Africa, especially some parts of Africa, such as South Sudan, the newest country in the world, to get to our point of democracy in a decade. These things take time. And also what happens is, as we found out in our own country, you know, the rise of the middle classes, people have more money, they can have choice. But the money starts at the top and has a trickle-down theory, and we've got to give that time. So am I optimistic? Yes, I am. I think sub-Saharan Africa, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, potential is enormous. Young population, educated in Uganda, certainly the educational system is reasonable. And I think in a period of time, we're going to see great change there. Great change, for better.
Robbie, let's talk about Spain.
Right.
What brought you here?
Oh, another one. One of my darling friends, Rebecca, had a house here. Rebecca Swift. And she said, oh, Robbie, you know, you're doing your thing and here and there and everywhere. Why don't you pop out to Galcine and have a look? All right. You know what I'm like. Mm. All right, I'll come out. All right, bye-bye. And I literally fell in love with a beautiful pueblo. It is stunning. And found myself coming back more and more and more. And eventually, I just had this sort of... Because I've had experience of doing things on the hoof, so to speak.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm going to live here. And bear in mind, I've got a son, you know, I've got one son. So it was just trying to persuade him, was that all right for me to come out and do this? And
your son is grown up.
Yeah, he's 32. So he's...
Oh, okay.
He's
very... Dad, please go. Yeah, really. Honestly,
you've attained some sort of independence.
Yeah. I'm a bit worried about that. He did say that.
Doesn't love me, you know.
No, and so I was sort of merged into Galcine. And before I knew where I was here.
Okay.
In amongst it, which is lovely. Well, I find it wonderful.
Right, now, for those of us who don't know Galcine, it's a pueblo with a population of about 2,000 people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's on the Serranía de Ronda, and it's a place I'm afraid we talk about quite a lot at Home with the Hogs. You'll have to forgive us. It actually is our pueblo. So
we're
kind of rooted there.
We are.
Galcine has a glittering array of artistic expats, in which you've kind of meshed as a fundamental person.
Yes.
But how important is it for you, the pueblo and its people, that you're connected?
Oh, it's hugely.
Easy is it for you to connect?
I think the rural Spanish are fundamentally very polite, are very welcoming. What I find, they do have conventions and traditions with a small C and a small T.
Mm-hmm.
The church does play a part in that in terms of its tradition and its movement and how fiestas happen. But also, what I found is that if you do the little things really, really well...
Like
the,
what?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Stop
the greetings.
The greetings. Yeah. Stop for a chat. Have time.
Make the time.
The time.
That's so what I don't do. I'm always in a hurry.
Yeah.
They're not.
I was saying to you before we came on air, Kit, you know...
Why aren't they in a hurry? We're in a hurry.
We're mad.
But it's about
two,
it's going to be 2 o'clock and everything will shut. Nobody seems to care.
No one cares. Well, what are you worried about? You know,
somewhere in a sort of parallel universe, isn't it? Penn and I are, anyway.
Well, we try and do things exactly on time. You know, we have to be here on time. We have to be there. Well, yes and no. I think that the local Spanish that I've met, when I've just said good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and I've got involved in the little community in the street where I live, you feel very part of a family. And that's the most important thing. They don't give a monkey's that I'm a middle-aged white homosexual. They haven't got a problem with that at all. What they've got a problem with is if I didn't interact with them.
Or tried to speak Spanish.
Right. They have no problem with the fact that that my son is a different ethnicity to me and obviously was adopted. No problem with that at all. What they want and what they like is that I'm doing what they think is a very normal thing to do, bring up a child. Even though he's 32, that's all long since gone. But you know what I mean? They do that very simple thing.
Perhaps it's a certain amount of for them, entertainment and something a bit different.
Yes.
And just like, exciting, like, whoa, you know, a little bit of stimulus.
Yeah, if there were no gearies, how bored would they be?
Well, exactly. And they like that.
Particularly, well, it is an assumption, of course. Flippant comment. But particularly in the gym, Robbie.
Yeah. Oh, the gym.
Tell us briefly about the gym.
I joined at... They've opened up a gym class in Gowson. It's the hive of where everybody goes, you know. And there's me, Tommy.
You mean you.
Me, yeah, that's it. And there's a gym class. Well, there's a gym spinning class.
Spinning. What is spinning for those of us who don't
know?
Well,
for people who are mentally deranged, it's perfect. it is a static bike to music. So you're pedalling like a little, you know, man possessed to music, and you get on the saddle whilst pedaling.
Right. Absolute no-brainer.
No-brainer. Not like step, where you fall off the step and look like an idiot very quickly. This is all about pedalling, like this, you see, to music, where you perspire like the proverbial racehorse, and you do 45 minutes of this.
And you've got a teacher in front of you who's also spinning.
Yeah, he's called Jesus, which I think is quite popular because people do think he's holier than thou. and he gives us little instructions to different music, to pedal harder or pedal slower or get off his saddle, things like that.
Right, okay.
So I've met a group of the Spanish girls, and they are delightful.
Foul language.
I had to do a whole 15-minute session the other day on English swear words.
Oh,
and they
went,
oh, I know that one, yeah, know that one. What's this mean? And, you know, it's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They are delightful. And for Valentine's Day, they got us all dressed up in red. Well, they thought Robbie needed a skirt.
Oh.
So they put me in a skirt.
Did they make you one specially?
I don't know, but it fitted quite snugly. That's all I was going to say. And they insisted that I did the whole class in this red skirt with hearts on it, with a bandana across my head with a heart on it. And they took photographs of it. They giggled their way through. And then,
I wonder if you'll be on the website, the Gownsine website.
I am.
You are?
I am on the blasted website. The little darlings, they've got me in full frock. Singing along, having a ride.
Right.
Oh, they love it. Don't go on a WhatsApp group with them. It doesn't stop. They tell people that what my mother would class as the bleeding obvious at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
you know, did you see? Did you go? Have you been? Are you coming? You know, fabulous. Fabulous. For a fella like me, it's great. You feel quite warm and at home.
You're listening to Robbie Jeffries at Home with the Hogs. We're going to take a break now and we'll be back with today's story right after these messages.
This is Talk Radio Europe.
At Home with the Hogs.
Traveling in a fight-out combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under? A women go and men wonder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
That's a predictable intro to today's story, given that it's set in Australia. It's by Robbie Jeffries, and it's called Dry Spring. Robbie, set the context.
Well, it all starts off in the early 80s when my darling father really tried to butch me up and sent me to Australia. My uncle, who I went to see, knew this guy called Pete, who had a big station in Australia, and thought the cherry on the cake to my whole final road of puberty might be to work in this station.
So how old were you?
I was a very young 19-year-old boy with great aspirations. And, of course, as anybody knows, when you are a part of a minority, you tend to be quite loud. I'm not quite so camp now, but then I was quite loud.
When you were part of a minority?
When you're coming out as an individual person who's gay, and I don't make a lot of fuss about it, but then, you know, you try to be larger than life.
Was Australia, the outback of Australia, was that a sort of...
Not really. Well, you see, they thought, I know.
We'll cure him.
We're curing him here. Yeah. This is a sort of... you know,
right.
Induction by fire. That'll be the great thing. No, and peace, love him. Out. Right, okay. They'll sort him out. Crikey, when I think back. So you can, so the scene is set at the end of a runway, as you can imagine, in Australia.
End
with
of a runway.
End of a runway.
At the end of a runway, why?
Oh, well, because I've been there 3 months, and it was time, without giving too much of the story away, I thought I was there just to talk to Pete about the muster. Pete had a different want for me being there at that time.
Okay, so Pete is the owner of the station.
Pete is the station owner. He's 6'4", well, it was 6'4", about as wide. Gritted skin from the sun.
Yes.
Hair, you know, all over the place, and probably a bit of a boozer's nose. And okay. A toweling hat. So you can picture this man in a bit of
gorgeous.
A stomach.
Yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous look of a man. I mean, he's no problem when taking him to a bar. People just looked in sheer horror. But he was an incredible man.
Okay. So I'm there. Robbie, we must have this. So I have to say that this drama is it's not for the faint-hearted.
No,
and it
not.
Contains a modicum of bush language, which we have persuaded Robbie to tone down.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Dry Spring. Are you buckled in?
Are you ready? Are you ready? So you've done the introduction. So here I am, standing at the end of the runway, and here we go. I was thinking what I was doing here, standing at the end of the runway, looking out at half a mile of cleared bush on a cattle station approximately 200 miles south of Alice Springs, known affectionately as Dry Spring. In a temperature that could fry an egg and a heat haze on the horizon that completely blurred it out. John Houston would have described the sky as big, not a cloud in it. And here I am waiting for Pete, the station owner, who says he has something very important to tell me. And here he is, right on time, just getting out of that beaten up old ute. Ah, oh, how hot is it today, eh, Pete? I said, mate, some of the boys already got their sou'westers on. Pete, it's 38 degrees. Look, mate, cut the crap. For a second, look, keep this under your hat. Peter, dear, before we start, I did say to you before that I can't marry your daughter. I know it's difficult for you, and she's worth 7.5 million square acres. And I remember thinking, 7.5 million square acres, that's the size of Wales. I'd always fancied being the Prince of Wales, and let's face it, with 7.5 million acres, I could have owned it. Anyway.
Ah, shut up, Rob. We all know you're an arse bandit.
Oh, no. How do you know? Well, mate, now listen. Every time you open your mouth or move, the whole bloody world knows. Now, pin your ears back. I want to learn to fly. Pete, lovely darling man, lovely, listen. Look, doesn't that bloke out of Yulara run a few lessons?
Oh, you mean the law enforcement constable, Constable Bluey?
Is that his name? I thought his name was Marvin.
Ah, that may be so. We just call him Bluey.
All right, dear, go on, Bluey, what is it?
Yeah, it stands for, wait for it, bloody lazy useless idiot.
Oh, very good, Pete, very good. That's sweetheart, that's lovely. Well, just quickly, what do you call me then? Oh, mate, that's simple. It's very simple. You're known by the boys as the bandit. Oh, that's sweet. That's nice. I like that. I could live with that.
I haven't finished yet. Open brackets, ass. Close brackets.
Who else knows then? Look, mate, as he placed his hand on my shoulder, do you remember when you went to Alice with the boys after the muster, he said? I said, yes. And he said, you go, and I gave you $2,000 to buy them a night out. I said, yes, I remember that. Well, they had a night out, and before you say anything, I know some of them didn't want beer. Oh, Pete, oh, darling, they weren't pretty, sweetheart. There's none of them pretty. However, you did have a few sherries and insisted the pub played your favourite record by some bird called Eartha Kitt. Honestly, Pete, I can't remember. So you can't remember just trying to chat up on the blokes behind the bar? No, Pete, no, I can't remember that. No. That's useful for you because one of my blokes spent the next 2 hours knocking 3 shades of poo out of that bloke's wife's brothers. That's why the bar went quiet. And all I heard from that night is he might not be your puff, but he's our puff. Ah!
Ah, yeah, well done. Welcome back, Sherlock.
Look, Pete, look. I better go and thank them. Don't be silly.
Don't be silly. Their bonus from the successful matter you help with that abacus thing paid them $1,000 on condition you arrive back at the station in one piece. So it's me you got to thank, and that's why you're outside the shed, or should I say hangar. So open the bloody doors, boy. We're going flying. Pete, lovely. Darling, listen. I realise that Marvin has sent you the manual, Flying for Dummies, with a lot of pictures, but surely waiting for him might be the best option. Rob, you don't know then. No, well, Bluey had a little sideline going, which he sold by the gram. Only one little problem. The chief, Bluey, caught him selling his wares outside the church on my bloody station. So he's otherwise occupied at Her Majesty's pleasure. So, you lovely poofter, it's you and me.
Oh, Pete.
So why am I here? Well, pictures are one thing, but the manual has words in it. And that's where you come in. You're going to read it while I do it.
Oh,
I trust you're talking about the flying now, Pete. Shut up, Rob. Push the plane out. The plane was a Cessna 172. And in later years, when I had one of my many, many trips abroad, I'd got 400 hours on one of these. According to the manual, Pete, darling, it's not a plane, it's an aircraft. Oh, is it the way you're going to be? Pete, listen, I have a lot of time for you, but again, this is a really risky thing.
Nah, it's all coming out now. You've got a yellow streak.
No, just a healthy streak of self-preservation.
Well, call it whatever you like. All I want to do is start the thing, run it up and down the runway and a couple of times and call the whole thing a bloody day.
Looking back, this should have been the point where I bailed. Faked illness or something, but I had such respect for this man. I suppose you'd call this the beginnings of a monumental-sized guilt trip, and certainly it was. But how could I turn down Pete? Life was tough here. Pete had fought hard for every acre he had got, staking his patch out the size of Wales himself. He'd been bitten by a brown skate twice, somehow survived. He'd brought up a disabled daughter on his own, and his wife had died of alcoholism, possibly something brought on from the trauma of childbirth, as their daughter Diana was caught in the birth canal too long before help arrived. Pete was not the sort of man to ask for help with his wife when his wife died, and when the suggestion that Diana should be removed and taught in a special school in Adelaide, Pete simply could not accept that as a possible option. You see, he loved his wife, and Diana was his last link. So he persuaded the authorities, who at the time had little or no real justification, that he would ensure that she was educated, that all her needs would be met. There was only one problem. Pete was illiterate and innumerate. Diana was a lovely, lovely lady. She suffered from cerebral palsy and as sharp as a knife, but the poor lady, sometimes just in the middle of the outback, just couldn't quite be understood. So I pushed the 172 out of the shed, manual under my arm, knowing this was not a good idea, but realising that I had a choice, and the choice was to go with it. OK, Pete. First section, pre-flight inspection. Take that syringe-looking thing with a screwdriver, at the end, attached, and go under the aircraft and look for something that resembles like a bar optic and fill it with whatever comes out. Oh, hang on, Pete, that's fuel. Right. OK, well, why am I doing that? Hang on, I'm just looking that up. You're checking that there's no air in the fuel. Oh. Now, empty the thing out and use the screwdriver attachment and open the bonnet. I know now, it's called the engine cowling. And pull the dipstick out. And check for shavings in it and check the level. Why? Oh, it's in case the engine wants to blow up. Oh, that's good. Yeah, done that. OK, there's a lot of blurb about flying surfaces, but we're not going to be flying, are we, Pete? So let's skip that. OK, Pete, start in the engine. We need to get in the aircraft. You get in the left-hand side. Remember, put the brake on, which is between your legs, and works like a car brake. Ah, right, okay, mate. Oh, mate, we're cooking now. Pete wasn't wrong. We were cooking. It was 38 degrees outside the aircraft, but inside the aircraft, it must have been its 40s. So I was eager to get the big bug-bashing thing at the front going, known now as the prop. Pete, listen to me. According to this, you have to prime the engine. It's like a choke out of the ute. But in this case, you do it in and out twice.
Where's the choke thing?
On the left-hand side, lovely, next to your left knee.
Oh, yeah, mate, got it. Got it in and out twice, all done.
No, Pete, I'm reading. Put the key in the ignition and turn it one click and then push those two black switches next door.
Oh, mate, there's a whirring noise, whirring away.
Hang on. That, according to this is the magnetos. Don't worry. Don't worry, I say. Famous last words. Oh, on the right-hand side, there's a red knob thing. Push it in.
Mate, we're starting the engine. I don't know what you're thinking about.
Pete, push the bloody thing in and stop flattering yourself. All right, sweetheart, all done. Right, put your feet on the pedals and push the pedals down twice. Your right-hand side on the black knob, and with that on your left-hand side, and the key. And as you can see, I was blurbing all these words. At the same time, push the black knob in until the engine starts.
Strafe, Rob, it's going!
Pete, right. Take the handbrake off and relax the pressure on the pedals.
Oh, mate. We're moving. How do I steer it?
Oh, my God. There's nothing here about that. Try using the pedals.
You're right, Rob. Oh, mate, that's better. Let's see if we can go faster.
In two words, Pete, we don't want to do that. We don't go faster.
Where's your sense of adventure? In the bottom of my underwear, along with my breakfast. Look, mate, don't worry your pretty self. I'll push this back one in and see what happens.
I think now I know what Neil Armstrong must have felt like at the point of liftoff, except in my case, there was no countdown and none of the world's media to witness the event just in case they need to find the bodies.
Put it out again, Pete. Please, put it out.
Why?
Just stop it now, Pete. Please stop it.
You never told me how to do that. Oh, God. The aircraft lurched forward as though it had found a different gear. The cloud of dust assembling behind the aircraft turned as if by divine intervention into a tornado. The manual that I was grasping fell out of my hands at the same time, at the same speed as my jaw dropped. We are going to die. I looked at the side of the aircraft just in time to see the left hand separate, the land, should I say, separate from the wheel and feel the wing pick up the weight of the aircraft.
Pete, sweetheart, we're off the ground!
What's that? What's this steering wheel for? Said Pete. Look, if I push it down, it goes down, and if I pull it up, it goes up. Now, that's bloody brilliant. I don't give a rat's backside. Get this thing down.
What's your potty mouth?
Oh, look over there. There's a station house. I don't care if you can see God himself. Put this thing down.
Well, you better go to part that bloody book that tells us about landing then, hadn't you?
At this point, I found the manual, frantically searched the index for anything mentioning landing. I couldn't. So I grabbed the radio, picked up the microphone and shouted pitifully,
Mayday, Mayday, Mayday.
In quite a camp voice. I'd seen it on a great film once. All Pete could come out with at this point was,
it's not May, mate, it's August. Don't ask me why, but I just shouted at this point, we're doomed, we're doomed. Mate, I'm having a ball thanks to you. There's nothing to this flying thing. I've seen reach for the sky. Let's try a barrel roll.
Pete, listen. Listen, sweetheart, listen. Remember, after he barrel rolled, he crashed and lost both legs. Just saying.
Oh, mate. Oh, but he was a good bloke.
Pete, now's the time to listen to me. I love you like a father. I would like to see my dad again and be able to communicate with him on a one-to-one physical level as opposed through a medium. So with that in mind, would you be so kind as to put this thing down? Hey, Rob, do you remember what? Did you remember Bluey? Yeah, I remember. Yeah, you talked about Bluey. Bluey, you flew under those power cables. What power cables? The ones directly in front of us.
You've got to be kidding me.
It was at that moment when I looked at him, and his feet and arms were working in perfect harmony. The aircraft gently pitched down as if by magic, and I saw the power cables disappear over the top of the aircraft. And I just looked at Pete and I said, "You've bloody done this before." And I must say, it was the butcher's voice I could ever, ever find at the time. "Ah, yeah, mate, look under your seat. Look under your seat and pull out what you find." Sure enough, in my hands, I had his logbook. A logbook, it's got pages in it. "Go to the last page and read out the pilot and command hours," said Pete, in almost an English accent, sorry. 10,500, and you stopped logging them 4 years ago? "I know, my new logbook's in the house." I said, "You ocean-going, fur-lined, wall-to-wall bar steward." "Yeah, I might be, mate. Got you good and proper, though, didn't I?" I didn't know at the time, but Pete had just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and would be dead in the next 6 months. And if by cruel irony, my father was diagnosed 2 years later. The two most important men in my life who taught me the joy of laughter and how to live. There you go.
Whoa.
Dry Spring by Robbie Jeffries. Thank you for the... And flabbergasting performance. We loved it. So Pete's spoof, quite extraordinary. Well, I mean, how premeditated was that in retrospect?
Oh, it was absolutely premeditated. You see, what had happened is that by some fate, what people thought was a toughening up exercise, because I got to know his daughter very well, Diana, and... He
wanted you to marry her.
Yes, yes. He thought that would be a fabulous thing. And in his little mind, he was thinking there'd be no problem there. I became part of his little group of friends, and he was a very private man. And as such, he sort of forgot about my campness and gayness. I was a very important part of his life. And conversely, the things I learnt and was taught by this man are phenomenal. You know, just his charisma, his presence, and his sheer guts. I mean, when we found out, he'd been living with pancreatic cancer for 4 months. He was in excruciating pain most of the time. Mm-hmm. He knew he was terminal. He refused to take medication. It was all there. He'd all hidden it all. And so he wanted, and he knew if he took medication, he couldn't have done the things he wanted to do. So this man knew he wanted to smoof me, and and he wanted to have some fun with it. So he didn't take his medication that morning because he knew he could not fly the aircraft. He shouldn't have been flying it anyway, to be honest with you. But that was just amazing. And to see this man laugh as we landed.
Loving it.
And
he must have been laughing as well.
I was doing a lot of other things as well. It was just a glorious moment, and one I will always hang on to. Just to watch the aircraft go under the bridge and swoop back up, and to see this little man's face light up.
The joy.
And he did. I mean, honestly, I didn't put it in. And this finger just rose up like that, you know, right in my face.
Got ya.
Gotcha. Get yourself out of this one.
So this was a Cessna where you sit side by side.
Yeah, side by side. No, yeah. Side by side. So it was.
Was that what inspired you to go on and learn to fly?
Yeah.
Because you became a pilot, didn't
you? I did.
After that.
I became a flight instructor for a while. So I tell the story, and I've cut a lot of this out because, you know, you don't want to know how we do this and how we do that. But you could see how clever and how good he actually was.
Yeah.
This was professional bush flying, where you fly by the seat of your pants. And if you put that thing down, you are on your own.
Yeah.
You know,
you're
going to have to wait in the blazing sun and hope your radio works until someone can find you. And that will take 12 hours plus.
Right.
So, you know, people sort of forget how large this place was, but it was the size of Wales. So to actually get across, I mean, his driveway was 75 miles long, his driveway, to the station house.
Yes, the scale of Australia is extraordinary. When I emigrated, I wound up at a station in New South Wales, which is not the Northern Territory, the outback.
No.
But we had a paddock that was 17 miles long.
Yeah. And when you do mustering, you know, people forget that the cattle may be... if you shut the boreholes down from the base of your station, which might be 200-300 miles away, it takes about 2 or 3 months to get these cattle within 100 miles of the station house.
So that's the way to get them to the station, yeah, yeah. By shutting down the boreholes.
But, okay. but again, you must, you have to have them in certain distances, because you can't get cattle in midday sun to walk more than 10 or 15 miles. They'll die. So you really have to do it very, very slowly. So the borehole has a big, like a billabong, for the want of better words, a huge trough of water, and you let it go down slowly, so the cattle get inquisitive to know where the next water's coming from.
Without dying of thirst,
because this is a very big problem. And so they would go to the next borehole, get themselves a climb, and then we'd shut that borehole down, and then they'd come closer and closer.
And they
closer.
Knew which way to go?
Well, there was no other way, yeah. I mean, what was interesting is that we would have possibly 3 or 4 boreholes. So they start off with five at the top. Well, in our case, there was 10, and it worked down like a triangle.
Right.
Do you see where I'm going? Worked down to one that was 50 miles outside the station house, and then you mustered them in.
So how do you know how many cattle you've got?
Well, the abacus thing.
The what?
The abacus thing.
The abacus thing?
Yeah. It was a simpler device. Bear in mind, what you have in Australia, they're drovers. They don't,
like cowboys?
Yeah, yeah. At the time, that they don't read or write. They've been brought up on the road, moving from one station to the other station. Now, they can count. The joke was they can't count beyond 10 without taking their shoes and socks off. You know what I mean? It was that sort of logic. So I didn't know. I was a young kid. I didn't know what to do. And people said, oh, you're a child of the master, mate, because you've got the numbers. And I hadn't got the numbers. I'd failed CSE maths. What the hell was I going to do with numbers? Anyway, I went to Alice and got these, well, had them sent, abacuses. And do you remember I was explaining the other night? So, in other words, there would be 4 or 5 breeds of cattle.
And this hadn't been done before on the station.
Oh, God, I'm sure they had got some sort of thing, but no one had thought about actually asking anybody, because they're miles away.
To set it up.
This is your variation on the thing.
Variation. Well, I mean, they had things like clickers. They had electronic clickers that they could actually count. There were beams that when the cattle passed the stall, it would count it. But the point with it was you had to know roughly how many you'd got as they were coming through the chute.
Yes.
Because Pete wanted to work out in his mind how much trailers he needed to get his cattle to market. So it was ballpark figure.
Yes.
So when they saw a brown one, they put saw 10 of them. The 10 went across the top of the abacus. And when they got the whole of the top row filled up, which was about, well, in this case, 100, they'd put it back and move one to the other side and start all over again. So they could get a ballpark figure of how many cattle they'd got.
Mm.
And then they have to go through and make sure they hadn't rounded up someone else's cattle.
How on earth do you do that?
Well, they should have been branded or they should have been tagged. Mm. Some of them don't. You miss them. You miss them. I mean, you're going to miss someone in the middle of Wales somewhere, aren't you? So,
do you get camels there? Do you get camels?
You do.
Wild camels.
Well, they were brought over. They were brought over from the Middle East because it was a brilliant thing, way of transporting things. But they just, you know what the Australians are like? Ah, yeah, you've had enough, Neil. Let that one go. Well, they thrived. And
they're wild now.
They are from a strain. And the irony of this now is they're exporting the camels from the outback back to Saudi.
Never.
They are. I was told one of the strains they've got makes great racing camels.
Really?
Do the Aussies race their camels?
They race anything. It's got a back to it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't believe what they'd race. Anyway, so they go. And in Saudi, they love it, I'm told. They get a whole wad of them and off they go. And they are running wild. They are now a nuisance, though. They are becoming a nuisance.
Imagine it'd be quite scary, a camel.
Yeah, well, you see, a camel can travel for miles without any water and can stamp down fences or anything that you've got to keep your cows in. And they're naturally quite inquisitive. So they want to be round and see what's going on. And you do see them trompsing across their eye. And people say,
camels, you know, they're horrible things. They don't go away, you know.
And I'd say, well,
when I first got out here, you know, we had a load of them. We brought them over. They're bloody useful, but now useless.
Because
technology had brought up. You know, they were there to literally transport your equipment to where the...
And then somebody invented the car.
The car or something, you know.
Yeah.
But that they... Or road trains.
Muslims, they would form these huge road trains in the 20s where they'd just walk these camels pulling all this stuff.
No.
Yeah, because it was a cheaper way of doing it and it was on rough ground. People forget that the track was just that. You know, it's all bitumen now, but before it was just desert.
Camel track.
And camels could plod along at 3 or 4 miles an hour all day, every day, and you'd get your stuff to where you wanted to go. And it would be a lot better than having something that may break down or may not break down.
Yes.
So they've been there a long time. And now they use them, I don't know what they use them for. I mean, a lot of tourists ride them, a lot of people are out here.
I'm sure there's a tourist angle on them. Yeah.
So it's quite interesting what they do with camels, but yeah, the outback is a place to go. It's just...
I don't know, actually.
You don't want it.
You were way, way outback.
Oh, I was way, nowhere. I mean,
how far from Alice was this, actually?
200 miles south. Right. 250 miles south. Right. But you've got to remember what they do in Australia if you're trying to find anywhere.
No, I don't know.
No, it's a wonderful thing. If you say, excuse me, could you tell me where Dry Spring is, please? And we were in a place called Mount Isa. I said, yeah, man, yeah. I know about that, yeah. So you want to go out of here, you want to turn right, you go for about a day. And then you see a little sign. Don't miss the sign. It's on the right-hand side. It says turn right. You've got to turn right there. Otherwise, you're bugger.
Robbie, you've been brilliant, man. We are... The time is nearly 1 o'clock, which means that that's all we have time for today. Our thanks to our guests on the programme, Stephen Rowell, an energy channeler, Reiki practitioner and holistic vet, and the inimitable Robbie Jeffries. Well, Robbie, will you come back?
Yes, I'll come back. You want me to do the Pol Pot thing?
Yeah, let's go to Southeast Asia.
Let's go Southeast Asia.
And, of course, to you for joining us
here. Thank you for listening.
At Home with the Hogs. Until next time, then, we wish you all that is good. It only remains to be serenaded by the blackbird, Bertie.
Tweet, tweet.
Happy weekend.